This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. I'm David Prest.
I'm Camilla McGibbon.
And I'm Keith Davis.
Okay, I'm going to start this podcast with some dreaded words. And now, sport. Does that sound Alan Partridge?
Yeah.
I've just switched off.
Well, it is a moment, isn't it, in every sort of news bulletin where they say, and now we cross to so-and-so for the sport. Yeah. And you either love it or you hate it.
Well, I think if you're part of a team, and I think if you like going out there on a rainy day like it is today, then great, you're watching. And if you've got a hero, you're watching to see who she or he is.
Yeah.
I'm not. Sorry. I'm curled up in bed with a good book.
But then you've got a Canadian ice hockey it's ice hockey and ice hockey, isn't it, really?
Oh, it's ice hockey and ice hockey.
Yeah.
And when I was growing up, there were only six teams, four of which were American. Well, they were sited in American cities. They were all Canadians. They were all Canucks. They'd all grown up playing in the middle of the road on the ice.
Well, when I was in Sunderland managing an ice hockey team, we had to import three.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Isn't this? We've done how many episodes? 30 something episodes. And suddenly Keith has confessed that he once managed an ice hockey team in Sunderland.
I did. It was called the Croce Chiefs, and we played in the National League. But to be honest, we had to import three Canadians over for our front starting line.
There you go.
Because there wasn't enough local stock in those days. But it did create an interest. And I think that's what sport does.
Ah.
You know, it creates a local and certainly a national interest.
Well, that's really good. I mean, that's the reason we're talking sport, or we started talking about sport, because our guest today is Paul Evans, who runs a charity called Leadership Through Sport and Business. We're going to be talking to him about how he runs the operation. Which brings me to the next question, which is, who are your sporting heroes? Very important, particularly for inspiring young people.
Eric Bristow. I was out again last night playing darts, and I won my singles 2-1 on double one in both legs. It was tripe, but Bristow, for me, he had the...
Is he the crafty cockney?
Yes, he's the crafty cockney.
Oh, yeah. Right, yeah. Gotcha.
He got that problem with throwing. You know, he couldn't let go of the darts towards the end of... But he brought on the Power Taylor, because they were a duo. And
Vince the Power Taylor.
Yeah, and he was,
your
world champion for 17 years. So, you know.
I'm going to give you mine, which is Derek Randall. Nottinghamshire in England.
Yeah, cricketer.
The biggest character to play English cricket in the 1970s. Mm. The most extraordinary fielder of a cricket ball you've ever seen. So fast. And his great moment in 1977 in the centenary test, standing up to Dennis Lilly. Famously, Dennis Lilly shot him a bouncer at his head. He ducked underneath it, rolled over backwards. And in the process of getting back on his feet, he doffed his cap in one spectacular motion. And you could see the blood rise in Dennis Lilly. And every schoolboy of my age was obsessed with Derek Randall.
But if we're talking about people who really inspire in the sporting world, for me, it's people who do great things in sport, but then do other things on the back of that reputation. Yeah. So somebody like Billie Jean King or a Marcus Rashford, mm-hmm. who've taken up a cause, and maybe it's years on before they get their credit. Somebody like Billie Jean King's been at it for years and years and years. And suddenly people stand up in Wimbledon when she arrives and applaud. And they're applauding the cause. They're applauding equality.
Just in case you're concerned, this is not a new sports podcast that we've just invented. This is still Good Charity, Bad Charity. And our job today is to... Well, what's our job as a whole? Should we remind people what our modus operandi is?
Yeah.
We shine a light on the charity sector. We big up a sector that we love, and it appeals not just to our hearts but to our heads.
And I think we realise and we know from our past experience how challenging it is within the charity sector. And if we can bring some inspiration from others to the wider sector and the charity, for me that is a major benefit.
Fantastic. Shaking the tin at the charity sector and seeing what comes out at the bottom. Paul Evans is our guest. He's about to join us now. So this is Good Charity, Bad Charity. Should we let him in?
Yeah, go for it.
So, Paul, thank you for joining us. We shall get straight into it, if you like. So this is Keith and Camilla.
Hi.
We've just been discussing our sporting heroes.
Who is, then, at this stage? Because I think we want to unpack more than just sport within this podcast. But who would be your sporting hero?
So I was really interested in martial arts growing up, and my hero was actually Bruce Lee.
Right.
But not for the obvious, you know, he was a kung fu hero, but he was also a philosopher. You know, also created change within film and how people were represented in movies. So amazing for diversity, amazing for what he brought in terms of philosophy and reasoning and that culture.
Quite interesting, because quite a lot of links between, you know, well, philosophy and sport. I mean, Albert Camus was a goalkeeper, famously. Wittgenstein. Didn't Wittgenstein play ice hockey or something?
Oh, yeah. He was an outstanding Canadian ice hockey
player. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Absolutely. I mean, and another sporting hero would be Lennox Lewis for me as a boxer. And I'm thinking, you know, he's a massive chess fan. You know, big, avid chess player. Promoted it and I think created an after-school kind of organisation for chess players. Very interesting guy. So everybody's so multidimensional, aren't they? But they're my heroes for greater than the sport contribution. But it's the sport that brings it to life. It's the sport that got you engaged in the first place.
Paul, fantastic to have you along. You're the CEO of Leadership Through Sport and Business. You have a background in young people services, sport for development, mental health, homelessness, education and employability. And you've combined it with a successful career in the private sector for many years. Let's start, because I know that you've actually written quite a lot about the positive sense that sport, or the positive understanding that sport gives us for young people in particular, but building a better society. And you go back to that quote that Nelson Mandela said, that sport has the power to change the world. And, you know, I know you've done a lot of thinking, a lot of research about exactly why we have this link between sport and personal development or achievement.
I suppose I was always interested in, when we say sport has the power to change lives, change the world, what is it about sport? Is it the sport, or is it the people involved in the sport? Is it the youth worker delivering the sport as an intervention? Is it that personal relationship? How much can be attributed to the sport itself and the role of physical activity? So I guess I went down the avenue of exploring, you know, we have to have a desired outcome through sports. We have to be trying to get to somewhere so that it's not just sport itself. You know, is it the act of kicking a football around, or is it the fact that you have purpose in your life because you now have a team? You're turning up to something. You're getting physically fitter, mentally fitter. But sport has an amazing power. It's a religion in this country. It's a religion in most countries, actually. But, you know, you don't have to love sport to love what it can do. And this is where I come from. I'm not the massive football fan, and I worked in a football charity, but I understood from a youth worker perspective the vehicle for change that sport offered. But so do many other things, music, you know, reading. As long as you know what the desired outcome you're looking for through that vehicle, and then really interrogate what is it about this particular vehicle that's impactful.
It's going to be really interesting to hear about what you do and the program that you work through and how effective it is. But Keith, Camilla, do you want to sort of come in at this stage?
It's leadership through sport and business. I'm interested in your target audience, shall we say, which is the disadvantaged. How do you find them? Is sport the hook? And then how do you get to business? And then I'm feeling my way here, but it's almost as though leadership is the first word, but maybe it's the last word, or maybe it's the outcome. So talk me through the process.
Okay, I mean, the leadership thing, and I'll do this in a bit of a tangent potentially, but you know, what ultimately the outcome here is confident people, successful learners, responsible leaders in the communities that they're in and within business. So that leadership aspect is really important from a citizenship point of view. And what does it mean to be an active part of your society and community? What we fundamentally do is connect young people from disadvantaged backgrounds to meaningful careers with leading employers. And we use a combination of sport and employability. And the employability is skills development, qualities, development, confidence, self-esteem, all of these things through a program, which could range from anything from 3 weeks to 3 months, depending on the qualification and the particular program on offer. But what we are doing in that boot camp is preparing and supporting young people to go into industry. Now, if you think about where do we sit in this, we are the bridge between where a young person is and the opportunity offered by a business.
Okay.
So we offer the preparation and support, but also the attraction and recruitment. We can get to young people in a way that businesses often can't. So we're in the heart of communities. We work multi-agency and collaboratively. We directly recruit to young people through social media. So we know how to reach them in a way that often businesses struggle. So if a business says to us, we have a problem of diversity, we want to do something about this, we want new faces, new talent, help us find it because we're under pressure, because that's something that's happening right now. We can go out and find that talent, prepare, support them, get them ready, place them into an apprenticeship opportunity, and then support that young person and their employer for 12 months in a pastoral care way. Because supporting each person in that relationship is really important, critical to the sustainment of that opportunity for that young person. And that's all I'm interested in. Does the young person actually sustain an opportunity? Does our intervention create real and lasting change in somebody's life? Volume is less important to me than it's ever been, but deep impact really is.
Keith?
Just coming back on that, obviously you're dealing with the youth element at the moment, and I think what you're talking about is developing their self-efficacy, how they understand the cause and effect of how they can move forward. Now, that obviously works in sport, but I think it works bigger in life. And what do you do to add the difference between winning and losing in sport to winning in life within your boot camp programs at the moment?
Yeah, it's an interesting one. I was saying just recently, you know, we're in a world where you can get medals for participating in things, and where, I mean, I have a 7-year-old stepdaughter, and she only has to turn up and there's a medal. You know, they're not taught so much about winning and losing, and actually, It's really important, I think, to build into programs and into interventions that sometimes you just, in sport, you win and you lose. But do you have a sense of winning and losing together? The same way we would think about this culturally in organizations. In this sporting world, yes, there's a direct win or lose, but how do you win? How do you lose? What qualities, characteristics do you demonstrate when you are winning and when you are losing? What does this say about your character? And so how can we develop character qualities and traits around that on and off of winning and losing? But it's also in the preparation for going for interviews and going into working life that it's not all going to go your own way. There's going to be disappointment, you know, and how do we handle that? How do we think about resilience and that bounce back ability? What skills and qualities do you need to handle disappointment but channel it? So all of these, what some people call soft skills, I think they're the hardest skills, by the way.
Oh, yeah.
Obviously, I assume from reading some of the information on your charity at the moment, you're also challenged, as a lot of people are at the present moment in time, with mental health issues of people via the pandemic. Are you using any specific training and awareness in that? Because I come from the background of being a director of leisure and manager of sports centres for years, okay, and see how people can grow through sport. But it's about the mental health we're dealing with now in other charities. Regardless of your age, people are now suffering. Now, have you got a particular bent on how you deal with that within your charities at the moment?
I think it's two things, really. So one, my staff team were all of a sudden confronted with more cases and more in-depth cases of young people who were struggling with mental ill health and needed support. So you have to ask yourself something honestly here. Are we best placed to deal with that level of support requirement? So what we did is did our best, right? Let's start with that. We did our best working with the young people that were coming to us and needing our support. And then we took part in more training. So we had mental health first aid training, and our frontline delivery staff underwent this training. And it was massively useful, really useful, because the cost of getting it wrong when you try to help somebody is really, massive. Can be really impactful. There's a line of where you've had some training, you can go so far, and then it's not us anymore. So that's where in this space, collaboration is important. Who do we refer you to? Who can we signpost you to for your housing needs, for your in-depth mental ill health needs while still being there for you. And you might be right for our program, just not now.
Yeah.
So there's this too. There's one to recruitment pressure. We have targets, but there's also having that staying true to yourself and thinking you're not ready. You need some other help, and we're going to help you find it.
This is Good Charity, Bad Charity. Our guest today is Paul Evans, the Chief Exec of Leadership Through Sport and Business, LTSB. Can you just give us a sense of, I mean, the size of the organisation? How many young people are coming through your books? The number of boot camps that you run, and I know that up and down the UK, specific hotspots that you look at sometimes.
Yeah.
Just give us an overview of the activities, if you like.
Yeah, sure. So I think this year we'll probably end at about 1.5 million turnover. So it's kind of fairly small, but large enough to start needing stuff, you know, infrastructure and people and all of these things. It's that tricky turnover point. But, you know, that's where we are in terms of turnover. We're about to place our 1,000th young person since we began, of 10 years ago. And this year, we'll actually place about 300 young people, I think, for definite, into opportunities across digital and technology, into finance, interestingly, into industries where there are diversity and gender imbalance issues. So finance there is. And if you think about the boards, FTSE 100 companies, only 15% are females. So we're also trying to do something about that. If I give you one example of a lead employer we're working with, NatWest have commissioned us to recruit 300 young apprentices across their digital and technology roles, from entry-level apprenticeships right through to digital skills degree apprenticeships. So that's the kind of profile we have now in the scale. But you know what? I hardly ever talk about turnover.
I noticed.
And probably 5 years ago, that's all you heard. I'd go to a charity event, and I will be careful not to go on a rant, and the first question would be, how big are you? Mm-hmm. What's your turnover? What's your growth? And I really avoid it now. I talk about impact, and I don't care about turnover. I care about profit or surplus. I care about not going bust.
Mm.
But anyway, that gives you a sense of where we are. Yeah.
If you have a sort of young person that you met through being involved in the charity who you now see in a position, give us a sort of personal story of somebody who has been helped by the organisation.
Do you know, there are so many young people who have helped helping them into opportunities when they've been caregivers or living in cramped conditions, you know, where violence has been prevalent in the house. I'm thinking of a guy who reached out to us, but he had such a mental health issue that he couldn't even regulate his diabetes. And he was living in a volatile home life. He just needed a stable environment. And he moved out into sheltered accommodation. But that wasn't the end of the story for him. And we were linking with him, trying to get him onto a program. But his accommodation, you know, it didn't even have flooring. Moved in there by the local authority, by the way. It didn't even have flooring. Well, cold concrete flooring.
Yeah.
Really shoddy place to live. So it's that basic needs thing, isn't it? If you haven't even got the basics, you can't concentrate. So this happened. He'd moved out, wanted to start our program. Wasn't really in the right setup to do it, but then COVID stopped us anyway, so we had to halt all recruitment. During that time, the young lad's dad was rushing to ICU. He later died of COVID. The lad then moved back to the house and now is thinking, I've got to find any job, not an apprenticeship, any job, because I can get more at McDonald's than I can do in an apprenticeship minimum opportunity. But what we were able to do is work with him and housing officials and family to help him wait, really. I mean, the whole family was in lockdown, self-isolation. We delivered food parcels. We supported him to be able to wait for our opportunities to come back. And he joined one of the programs and, as a result, went into an apprenticeship. Through all of this, though, he remained in touch with us and his mentor. So we provide a mentor to every young person that comes from outside the organization.
Yeah.
You know, from a range of industries.
Oh, that's key.
It's so massive, you know, it really is massive. But as part of our social mobility program, we were able to get him onto a program and now is successfully in his first year in an opportunity. You know, it's not been an easy ride, and the 12 months support is crucial here, because helping managing your new life is as important as getting one.
I just picked up on, just to go deep on this note actually about targets, I picked up on the note about you're not about growth and turnover and setting targets. But do you find when you go to funders or grantees that that's what they want? And if so, how do you get around that?
Do they want targets and growth?
Yeah.
I mean,
well, outputs, your targets. Yeah.
Yes, they do. And I think it's fair, right? I think it's fair to be targeted commercially with, you say you are going to do this, just because you're a charity, you shouldn't be held accountable to what you say you are going to do with money that's not your own.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, you might say a few years ago, there wasn't an equal relationship from funders and organisations, and therefore you didn't really have a say or able to co-produce a programme or influence the target setting. I think we've come a long way here where we can influence and educate to say that, do you know what, you might be thinking of social return on investment, or you might think that £6,000 is expensive to work with a young person, but it might be right to work with this young person. You can give us £5,000 and we'll cherry pick the easiest to work with young people and we'll put them all in jobs. But what have we done for structural youth unemployment? So we need to advocate on the case that some things are just more expensive. I think charities have become more confident in saying, we're the experts, this is what it costs.
Yeah.
Camilla, are you going to make a point?
Yeah, just wondering whether business in the 10 years that you've existed has changed in their listening, let's say, around this sort of thing, and therefore their understanding, and an understanding, hopefully, that unlike sport, it's not success or failure. It may be something sort of in between, and it may go towards success more at one time and more towards not so much success in another time.
You know, businesses usually change when they have to. Right, when there's a spotlight on industry. I mean, let's think about this last 18 months. We had this melting pot of COVID, the impact of the pandemic, how it shone a light on inequality that exists.
Yep.
It combined with the Black Lives Matter movement and then the real emphasis on diversity and then beyond that to be inclusion and equity. So businesses were all of a sudden hit on all sorts of fronts and having to justify why people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds don't make it to board level. Mm. So poorly underrepresented.
Yeah.
Why gender imbalance is still so prevalent. Why in some major banks, everybody comes from the same university and all look the same. So now businesses are thinking and they are shaping and they're listening to charity more than ever because they are saying, help us, we've been trying to do something. Now the pressure's on and some really want to. You know, let's not be cynical. Some organisations really want to do stuff, want to do the right thing in the right way. But now they're more open to, it's more of equal partnerships now. When businesses reach out to us, it's saying, we know you're the experts at this, and we're the experts at this, and let's create something truly amazing. I mean, our partnership with NatWest Group is fantastic from an equality point of view. We are able to shape services within a major bank. So yeah, I agree. Things are changing from a collaborative process, from a respect process, and there are drivers there now that were not before.
Clearly, the businesses that come to you are looking for people with specific skills as well. And, you know, to what extent are actually some of those things that they're looking for the sort of, I'm going to say, unsavoury elements of sport, but the sort of win at all costs? I mean, you know, there are businesses who want people who can be aggressive, they can take risks, they can challenge, and frankly, they can annihilate the opposition, who are other companies. I mean, when you get a company like that coming to you saying, bring us your best, bring us your powerful charging centre-forward or your rugby prop or whatever, what do you say to them?
Well, we have the conversation internally because there are going to be people that say, that's brilliant, it's a job, you know, it's an employment opportunity with a major bank. You know, and that could be life-changing. And there are some that say, well, let's think about the, you know, let's learn about the culture of the organisation. What does this mean? So, you know, we place young people into finance roles. Some industry within finance, you know, it's very typical to work long hours, to be expected to. Socialising is the norm. Your evenings, your weekends. For some, alcohol-based team building and networking is quite something. Mm-hmm. An organisation might be looking to recruit difference and diversity and representation from religious backgrounds. If you don't make the necessary cultural adjustments and your team building is still Friday night at the pub, or the way you make decisions is the guys yep. over golf on the Saturday or later in the evening, who might you be excluding? So there are things we have to consider about the environment of which we know about the organisation. Is this right for an entry-level young person? Right, because there are some environments that you're never going to change.
Yeah.
So we do have to be careful, you know, and being very sure about what you say no to as a charity, same with funding, same with opportunities, is equally as important as what you say yes to.
And along with, you mentioned it earlier, you know, that sense of responsibility, not pushing them into an apprenticeship, which is going to mean even more substantial economic hardship in a way, because an apprenticeship paying minimum wage could be half what they could get at McDonald's, as you say. How responsive are those organisations when you say, well, that's great, but you've got to do the right thing. You've got to pay properly. You've got to be paying real wages that can be substantive.
I think things are changing, and more businesses than not recognise that they can't just pay apprenticeship minimum wage if they expect to attract people from lower socioeconomic backgrounds, or where young people don't have the bank of mum and dad or can't relocate.
Yeah.
So when a business comes forward that says we only pay apprenticeship minimum, we say we can't work with you because there aren't apprenticeship minimum rents, there aren't apprenticeship minimum travel costs.
Yeah.
We only work with employers that pay living wage or that pay good starting salaries, that offer training and prospects and a qualification route, because we're about launching careers, not jobs.
Yeah.
We're trying to create something which is lasting for a young person. So we will turn organisations down, or there are examples where we've talked to HR departments, talked to senior leaders, and explained the situation. Because the other thing you can't assume is that everybody knows the problem. You've got to make it where somebody can live and where they're not having to hold two or three jobs together. So our average this year will be 18,500.
Ah.
That's about £10,000 more than an employer has to pay because we push it. But then there's a competitive element here. You take an industry like banking. It only takes two banks to do the right thing, and everybody else wants to do the right thing. You know, well, that's good.
Yeah.
That's good. That's how you get this osmosis of change.
You were talking there about levelling up and government support to the whole of the industries, I think, in the charity sector. If you had the opportunity to put your case at the moment about what's needed from government to support charities like yours and others, what would be the main messages you would try and push into them?
Okay, so I guess two or three things here. It would be sort the apprenticeship minimum out. There can't be an apprenticeship minimum of, I think it's now £4.81
right.
was just announced,
yep.
going up from £4.30. It's not what McDonald's pay, though,
yeah.
on an entry-level job. So what do they think young people that need money are going to do? That's an easy sell, I think. That's an easy pitch. If you think about between 2010 and 2019, £1 billion was taken out of youth services.
Mm.
I would say rethink your spending into young people's programs. Now, there has been a pledge just to put money into youth services. We don't really know what that means. There's pumping money into an NTS program that I don't think has been properly evaluated, and I'm not sure it's reaching, you know, the young people from the most disadvantaged backgrounds. So it just pumps it in with no real consultation in the sector. So I would say talk to the sector, talk to young people, hardly ever engage in the conversation about the things that affect them and their lives. Investment in youth services, stop cutting them, get rid of this apprenticeship minimum, and deliver an opportunity guarantee for young people that says, if you're unemployed for this amount of time, we guarantee you an apprenticeship or an opportunity. I mean, I heard an amazing thing the other day. This young lad said he stays at work later when he doesn't have to, just so he can wear his suit more. Because he has to take it off at the end of the day to walk back through the estate where he lives because he doesn't want any grief.
Yeah.
But he loves wearing it so much he'll stay later at work.
Yeah. Lovely story.
It's really interesting, isn't it?
Mm.
And there is something extraordinary, isn't it, about just the way that sport has always had a part to play in community, going back years, obviously. And you look through the pandemic at the way that amateur sports clubs survived, were getting people out there at the first opportunity. You know, I've got a 7-year-old who was doing all the way through lockdown, was doing football training on Zoom in the front room, you know, with coaches online. I mean, all of those sort of things, it's so important. And then in the middle of it, we've had sport centre stage with the Euros. Marcus Rashford has become this extraordinary figure. You know, there's extraordinary momentum, isn't there, around sport and money around sport, potentially. It must be the growth area.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think there's been a government pledge now, hasn't there, to put money into grassroots football and sports facilities. So, you know, we've lost 300 of them. We lost 8,000 community pitches over the last few years. But here we go again. Let's put the money back. But, you know, we welcome it. That would be the line, I would say. We welcome this investment. As long as it makes its way into communities. I mean, grassroots massively needs the investment. It can't be all about Premier League. So grassroots, you're lucky if you get anything. And yet that's where we have the next Olympians. That's where we have our next sports stars and role models of the future. But it needs to be linked to youth work, right? And I also think that the investment needs to be into youth work as a profession. Because if you give something credibility, a qualification, reprofessionalise something, it seems to be really important, isn't it? It gives it credibility as a profession. Yeah. It's so essential, this youth work relationship, that we need to have more youth workers trained, seen in the same parity as teachers and social workers, and be community activists. Because as soon as we link homes, schools and communities together, that's where you raise the potential of every young person in the country.
We've talked about growth. It's a word you used that you would rather not use. Talked about targets, ditto. And what it strikes me that you're providing is a sort of whole experience for the individual that you're bringing on, the apprenticeship, the mentoring and so forth. How then, Paul, do you actually grow what is a targeted, qualitative experience?
Yeah.
But you must want to, otherwise you won't be here in a few years' time.
Well, you're quite right. So I see growth as a result, not a cause. I do want to grow, but growth isn't the ambition. Creating more impact, changing more lives is. And by virtue of doing that well and demonstrating sustainment and lasting change, as we are now, we are growing. You know, we've probably doubled turnover in the last 4 years. I anticipate that we do that again. The ambition will never be for me at an away day to say, how do we reach 10 million? It might be to say, how do we reach 10,000 more lives, codify our models so well that we can replicate these across the country with a real clear funding model and programme. And then we will do that. So I have ambition to change lives. And by virtue of doing that, we will grow. But growth at all cost is not the ambition. But I do think as a charity, if you've got something really impactful, you kind of have a moral duty to grow.
And to share it.
You know, I think you do. You have to then think, how can we take this out and change more lives? Because you wouldn't be in the job if you didn't. If you didn't want to affect more impact.
Spot on.
Paul, it's brilliant to talk to you, and you're talking to us from that great sporting city of Nottingham. I think you're from Nottingham originally, aren't you?
Well, I'm from a town called Newark, which is very close to Nottingham.
A bit further up the M1.
Yeah, which was the city of football not too long ago, Nottingham, actually.
It does, of course, remind us of that famous Nottingham Forest manager, Brian Clough.
Yeah.
We started with Nelson Mandela. Let's end with Brian Clough. Brian, on taking opinions from players, he says, we talk about it for 20 minutes and then we decide I was right. And of course, the famous one, which was that I wouldn't say I was the best manager in the business, but I was in the top one. Brian Clough, RIP. So, Paul, you can take all of your leadership advice from Brian Clough, clearly.
Yeah, absolutely.
Obviously, lots of work being done at the moment and you're incredibly busy. So it's great to have you on the podcast and to share your thoughts about what's going on at the moment. Thank you so much. Keith, Camilla, anything else to add?
No, first class. Well done, Paul. And all the best for the future, mate. Keep it up.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me. It's been a real pleasure to meet you all.
Paul Evans there from the Leadership Through Sport and Business. An amazing outlook on everything, really, on how he runs the charity, how his outlook is, and that sense that sport is, you know, it's a very simplistic argument to say, well, if you're good at sport, then we can use you as a business kind of thing. And actually, he was really far more thoughtful about it than one might expect.
I think he was starting from a place where I think if we say, if you're good at sport, we have in our imagination somebody who's out there, you know, kicking the ball around 24/7, whereas really it might come down to the basic stuff like, can you get out of bed on your own? Are you self-motivated? He must have to say what he said today a million times, and I'm always full of admiration for that, because when he said you have to go to business or whoever he's applying to and explain that somebody is the only earner in their family, or that they might take the bus because it's cheaper than the tube, and so therefore that might take them longer to get there, and they might not have a suit to appear, and they might not want to drink. I mean, the whole thing about the culture of work is very different.
You know, I mean, it's quite, it is quite, you know, that flip side of it being a cultural kind of thing, I think it's important to get it across. And actually, the sense that he had that things are changing, he came over as a sort of more of a compassionate individual rather than a just sport, come on, let's go get them. I mean, it's not, you can't do that anymore, can you, basically?
I also love the fact that he says, if I am successful, if we as a charity are successful, it is our duty to be a model for others and to help them do the same. I almost didn't use the word because I didn't know how he would react, but he's kind of building in his own mind, I think, a franchise.
Yeah, there's a bit of that.
So this is the way it works. This is the network. This is the success. This is the process. Now you take that to your town and do it.
That's quite interesting, isn't it? I mean, and actually, as a charity, do you recognise that? Do you embrace that? Do you put that into your plan and say, this is where we're going? Or do you wait, just let that happen organically?
Yeah. I think he was incredibly grounded. And that, for me, made it easy listening. He was right in many ways that sport is a good starting point, but it's not the end point. You know, it's about how you move them on from that into the wider sections of life. Like Camilla, I loved his total understanding of address the basic needs, whether it's food, whether it's accommodation, you know, whether it's a safe environment, all those, and the bit about the mental health, about you don't have to be the font of all knowledge. Look around and see who and where there's a better person to help you or help them with it. Because his understanding of all those issues, I think, will continue to make them a great charity going forward.
Definitely one to watch.
Definitely.
And I think the other thing that came across that he was fully aware of was it's the good stories that make the most punch. The one about the kid who wants to stay at work to wear his suit. I actually was emotional about that. And that, I think, is to all chief execs and people who are going for money for charities, is get your stories right, because hit those heartstrings and maybe some hard-nosed business person will then go, actually, I'm prepared to put some money into that.
Yeah.
Great message to end. You've been listening to Good Charity, Bad Charity. You can catch up with more of our programmes on our website, goodcharitybadcharity.com, or on your own podcast provider. You can contact us on Twitter at GCBCPodcast. Our producer is Dan Hardoon from Whistledown Productions. We thank the Centre for Charity Effectiveness and the City Bridge Trust. We'll be back with more soon. That's it. That's your lot. Des Lynam.
Are we going to say goodbyes, or is that it?
Should we dance out to the tune from Match of the Day or something like that?